This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, senior writer for the Philadelphia Daily News, filling in for Terry Gross. Casey Affleck has appeared in 22 films over the last dozen years, but he's often been referred to as the other Affleck, a reference to his older brother, Ben Affleck. But that's changing now, thanks in part to Casey Affleck's starring roles in two films now out on DVD, The Assassination of Jesse James by the Coward Robert Ford and Gone Baby Gone. Both performances have won critical praise. Gone Baby Gone is the directorial debut of Ben Affleck. Among Casey Affleck's other films are To Die For, Good Will Hunting, Jerry, and Ocean's 11, 12, and 13. Gone Baby Gone is based on a novel by Dennis Lehane, who also wrote Mystic River. Affleck plays a small-time private detective who's asked to help find an abducted child. In this scene, he's visiting a drug dealer and is willing to help the dealer out with the problem in return for help finding the missing child, named Amanda McCready.
You found what you were looking for in Chelsea.
What I care about Chelsea?
There's one of the idiots that robbed you who lived there.
What idiot?
One that you and Chris beat with a pipe and shot in the chest.
I don't know about nobody getting killed. But if somebody robbed me and end up dead, well, you know, life. These are
Cheese, we got your money. It was buried in Ray's backyard. We want to give it back to you in exchange for Amanda McCready. The two police outside are the only other people who know.
No one gives a f*** about what you did. I mean, I didn't even like Ray that much. You're gonna get your money, the mother gets her daughter back, and we'll say we found the kid in the bushes or whatever. It's either this, real quiet, or it's 1,000 cops kicking your door in, putting their fat knees in your neck.
I spoke to Casey Affleck last fall when Gone Baby Gone was released in theaters. The film is set in Boston, where Casey and Ben Affleck grew up. Well, Casey Affleck, welcome to Fresh Air. When you had to craft this character, this private eye from this working-class neighborhood of Dorchester, were there people that you knew that you grew up with that you sort of drew on to craft this character?
Well, in different ways, yes. No, there was not one single person, but I knew the accent. I knew the way that people dressed and kind of what music they listened to, what kind of jobs they had, what their attitudes were towards everything from police to themselves to their children to I knew what kind of slang that they used. You know, it's just as an actor, it just means that you don't have to go spend 4 months listening to a dialect coach and trying to get the accent right and sort of wandering, you know, getting to know people there just to figure out, like, when they wear their sweats and when they put on their, like, ironed, jeans.
Boston is a character in the, you know, Dennis Lehane's novels, and it's clearly a character in this film, and I think really evocatively drawn out by, you know, by your brother as the director. Were there moments in the dialogue and scenes that you kind of felt like, yeah, this is really what I know, this is so familiar to me?
Well, I mean, just about all of it, except for the police work. You know, anytime we were shooting kind of in the neighborhood where the character lived, and with people, you know, there's a scene in a bar, and we go in there to talk to, we're looking for this missing girl, and this is a place where the mother hung out. And so we go in there to talk to people and find out, you know, see if we can get some information. And it's the middle of the day, and there's about 6 or 7 guys, you know, alcoholics, you know, kind of sitting there in the middle of the day, you know, and it's the kind of place where my father worked when I was a kid as a bartender. It's the kind of place where, you know, I actually spent some time as a kid. And when Ben was scouting the location, he went there in the middle of the day and he said, okay, all of you, I want you to just be here, you know, and next week on Monday, and you're going to be in the movie. They kind of all shrugged their shoulders and we showed up next week, and there they were, you know, still sitting there in their stools and probably hadn't left, and so they ended up in the movie.
You know, you know the director of this film very well. He's your brother, Ben Affleck, and he happened to be on Fresh Air right after you finished shooting this, and we asked him about what it was like directing you, his brother, and I thought we'd maybe just listen to what he told Terry Gross about directing you in the film.
It was really interesting, you know. It was kind of it's hard because you have to put on a different hat. You know what I mean? You can't have this conversation with your brother the way you'd have it with your brother if he's an actor in your movie. You have to treat him as you would treat an actor in the movie, which sometimes means, I mean, something as simple as trying to swallow the urge to strangle him, you know, or to be really curt with, like, just because I said to do it that way, that's why, you know, instead of going like, well, okay, that's interesting. I hear you. Let's process what you're talking about. So it was an exercise in self-discipline. But, you know, my brother, the thing that's really rewarding is that he's a really, really good actor, and he's typically been seen in, you know, kind of character roles as well. So I think, you know, I have the good fortune of being able to show an audience something kind of new and surprising that's also really good. And that's a rarity.
And that's Ben Affleck speaking with Terry Gross, talking about directing our guest, his brother, Casey Affleck. Well, Casey, now we have to turn to you. What was it like from your end?
Well, let me just tell you, first of all, he rarely swallowed the urge to strangle him. If he felt that urge, he usually went for it. And what's more is I don't think I ever heard him say, I hear you, and let me process that. It's funny characterization of how he worked. But he was, I sort of feel sort of the opposite. I don't feel like he ever had to put on a different hat. I kind of felt like, you know, a great advantage that we had was that we were kind of brothers who had this relationship for 32 years, that we kind of had every possible kind of conversation one could have. You know, I mean, I've asked for him for advice. He's come to me for advice. We've fought. We've helped each other, lied to each other, kept secrets, told the truth. And, you know, we've kind of been through it all. So, and what's more is that, you know, on top of it all, he had a fabulous way of talking to actors. I think just because he's been an actor, you know, he never got the megaphone and put on the boots and the scally cap, but never did like the old director thing. Listen, pal, and I guess say all your lines and go. You know, it was he just said, you know, I think it's like this. I think you should try it like that. Or it seemed to me like it was Ben that I'd sat on a couch next to 100,000 times, watched a movie with, and talked to him about it.
Well, Casey Affleck, you have another film out that's getting a lot of great reviews, and that's The Assassination of Jesse James by the Coward Robert Ford, the assassin being yourself. And this is just a fascinating story where you play this man who was, you know, an obsessed fan of Jesse James, who eventually becomes close to him and then does him in. It's a fascinating story based on a historical novel. How did you prepare for this role?
Well, there was a book by Ron Hansen that I read that was beautiful, a really great kind of character study, I thought, and of Robert Ford mostly, and of Jesse James, and then I read the screenplay by Andrew Dominik that was just stunningly beautiful and kind of ornate and strange in its architecture and, you know, just dialogue that just kind of like leapt from the page. And so those two things were kind of my blueprint, because there was nothing available about Robert Ford. There's obviously a lot available about Jesse James, but Robert Ford, there's very little online, very little you can find about him anywhere. There wasn't too much research that I could do other than learning to shoot a gun, ride a horse, and to be really knowledgeable about the period, you know, like reading newspapers every day, you know, every morning, read a newspaper from that morning in the 1880s, and just to kind of immerse myself in the period. And that did help.
You know, there's one review of your performance in this that said your metamorphosis from doormat to predator is a devastating feat of self-transformation. I mean, it is a fascinating character you play, a guy who is a hero worshiper, wants to be close to Jesse James, gets there, and then eventually betrays him. And it's an interesting, I think, question whether Ford becomes someone different or whether the assassin and the hero worshiper are really all part of the same package. Tell us a little bit about this character, how you saw him. What made him want to do in this guy he admired so much?
Well, it might sound strange, but I loved Robert Ford. I read the book and I loved him, and I read the screenplay and I loved him, and I loved playing him. There were times when I felt I hated him and things that he did that were really hard to do, but that's kind of like life. I find that's true with myself. I do and say things every day that I don't. I think, why did I do that? Why did I say that? You're an idiot. So, you know, I really felt for him. I don't think that he was an obsessed fan. I don't think that he was a kind of celebrity, obsessed predator. I don't think that he was any of those things. I think he was a 19-year-old kid, grew up on a farm, reading comic books about Jesse James, who was the youngest of in a big family. And people, no one ever thought that he would sort of amount to anything. And he kind of felt like he had an enormous amount of potential, that he was capable of doing something great, that he was, and specifically, you know, he thought that he could be just like Jesse James. And when he read these comic books, which he thought were real stories, obviously they weren't, he thought, well, if I can get close to Jesse James, you know, he's great, and he's smarter than everyone in my family and all these people around me who tell me I'm nothing. He will recognize in me my potential. He will make me his partner. And then there'll be comic books written about both of us. He was just had this immature fantasy. That's all it was.
Let's listen to a cut from this. This is from The Assassination of Jesse James by the Coward Robert Ford and our guest Casey Affleck. You're sitting around with Jesse James and some of the gang at dinner, and the conversation comes up about your character Robert Ford's worship of Jesse James, and you're provoked to talking about it. Let's listen.
Well, if you'll pardon my saying so, I guess it is interesting the many ways you and I overlap and whatnot. I mean, if you begin with our daddies, your daddy was a pastor of the New Hope Baptist Church, and my daddy was a pastor of the church in Excelsior Springs. You're the youngest of three James boys, and I'm the youngest of five Ford boys. Between Charlie and me is another brother, Wilbur here, with six letters in his name. And between Frank and you is another brother, Robert, also with six letters. And my Christian name is Robert, of course. You have blue eyes, I have blue eyes. You're 5 feet 8 inches tall, I'm 5 feet 8 inches tall.
I eat something.
And that was Brad Pitt laughing at the end, playing Jesse James. Our guest, Casey Affleck, was the Bob Ford, a member of his gang at the time. What led Robert Ford to assassinate Jesse James? I mean, if he seemed to worship and seemed to know so much about him.
Well, that scene that you just played is a bit of a pivotal moment in the movie. It's funny to hear it. I've seen the movie twice. I've never just listened to it, and it seems like a different scene to me. I just hear different things. It's such a halting delivery of that speech, and kind of weird. I mean, I'm smiling in that scene a little bit, kind of smirking and shy, and seemed like a kind of a, like, I don't know, a little girl in love or something. And just listening to it just sounds bizarre. But, you know, I think what follows that scene is they make fun of him. He sort of confesses that he has, you know, thinks that he's just like Jesse James. And he's embarrassed, and he gets his feelings hurt. And the next day he goes to the police. You know, it's just a kind of young, rash, impetuous, silly decision, because he's got such hurt feelings that he just lashes out by getting on his horse and going to town and telling the police that he knows where Jesse is and he could turn him in. Now that decision is something he just can't undo. Now now the police know who he is, and they kind of trap him. They don't leave him alone, and they say basically, if you don't capture or kill Jesse James, you're going to jail. And kind of, you know, they just keep pressuring him, and he has to do this thing he never wanted to do. He didn't want to kill Jesse James. It's not Mark David Chapman. He's not crazy. He's not. He didn't want to think he was replacing him. He just put himself in a spot he couldn't get out of. Of course, what happens is that after he does kill him, he gets sort of the thing that he always wanted. He gets, the whole country sees him. He's more recognizable than the President of the United States of America. It's a really, really big deal in the country.
If it's not giving away too much of the story, tell what happens in the years after he assassinates Jesse James.
Well, he becomes very famous. Everyone knows who he is, mostly from this one photograph that's taken of him. And he goes around the country. He does 800 performances reenacting the killing of Jesse James and a kind of theater production with him and his brother, who was there at the murder. And his brother plays Jesse James, and he plays himself. They go on Broadway, and they reenact the murder over and over. And at first, the audiences just eat it up. You know, they love it in the way that you kind of watch it like some of these reality shows. And then they turn against him. The mood of the country just turns kind of really quickly, and people start throwing stuff on him, at him on stage. They hate him. They think he's a, you know, a traitor. And it's mostly because I think people are still affected by the assassination of Lincoln. And so they once the idea gets out that, oh, Robert Ford is an assassin, then everything gets out of control. You know, people just hate him and they don't really know why. The other is that the people who kind of opinion makers, if you will, people in the kind of northern, northeastern cities, those are the only people that are writing about Jesse James. They write the comic books, and they also write the things after he's been killed. That's where Robert Ford is doing these plays, you know, in these big cities, these big urban areas, and they don't know anything about Jesse James. They were never affected by him. He was just some like comic book guy. They'd never been robbed by him. They didn't have a cousin who he killed. You know, Jesse James was terrorizing the state, Missouri. You know, it was they were going around it on their way out west just because they didn't want to be go near the James gang and those outlaws. So it was ruining the economy. It was horrible. He was really kind of hated by many, many people out west, but in the Northeast, people just thought he was fun. You know, they just thought it was nice to, it was fun to read about this guy from a kind of already a bygone era. So when he was killed, they made Robert Ford the kind of two-dimensional figure in the way that they had made Jesse James a two-dimensional figure. They just sort of slotted Robert Ford into this kind of fairy tale, you know, and he, of course, had to be the villain because he was the guy that killed the hero, and it ruined his life. So for the next 10 years, he was plagued by, you know, that one act, and he had to move from town to town because people would run him out of towns, and finally he was shot.
Well, a lot of folks know that you and your brother Ben and Matt Damon all grew up in the same neighborhood in Cambridge, Massachusetts. What got you interested in acting originally?
My mother's best friend in college became a local casting director in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Our families were pretty close. She used to bring Ben and me in, and with her children, and to be extras in movies when we were in school, you know, just little kids, 10 years old. And I didn't really care much about the movies. I just thought, like, well, this is a day off from school. I can graze over, you know, the craft service table for 8 hours. There's more candy than I'd ever gotten to eat. And, you know, you walk away with $15, and, you know, which my mom let me keep. So it was a fortune, and it was a lot of fun. So and then she would bring us in for, like, local, you know, commercials, like the weather commercial and the local news station, that kind of thing. And I kind of thought, like, wow, I'm incredible. I'm getting every part I auditioned for. It turns out that it was, I think she was only bringing me in. I was the only person auditioning. I was the only kid who had a mom that would let them like take 2 days off from school and go stand under a rain machine to do an ad for the weather guy. And but that gave me some confidence.
You were good, yeah.
And then I mostly, you know, the truth is it wasn't until high school that there was a guy named Jerry Specka, who was one of those teachers you kind of just hope your kid gets once in his 12 years of education. And Ben and Matt and I, and a bunch of other working, professional, talented actors, even a guy that's in Gone Baby Gone, he plays the child molester, Corman Earl. He had all of us as students, and he sort of inspired us all. I was playing baseball and, you know, throwing rocks around the street. I didn't have any, I didn't want to be an actor. And it wasn't until, you know, one summer I went and did the summer musical mostly because it was like 19 girls and it was me and that's it. And you kind of got to spend the summer that way. And that seemed a lot better than like sitting on the bench and the baseball summer league because I was smaller than everyone by that time. So I said, well, I'm going to go do this. Turns out I was tone deaf. They cut all my my solos, but it was a lot of fun. And then the next year I signed up for the drama class and I found that guy, Jerry Specka, and I've never really wanted to do anything else since then. And And I think that Matt and Ben kind of both feel the same way and had the same experience with Jerry.
Thanks so much for spending some time with us, Casey Affleck.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Actor Casey Affleck recorded last fall. His films The Assassination of Jesse James by the Coward Robert Ford and Gone Baby Gone are now out on DVD. Here's some music from the soundtrack of The Assassination of Jesse James, written by Nick Cave. He'll be Terry's guest on Monday. I'm Dave Davies, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, filling in for Terry Gross. Barack Obama's bowling misadventures and remarks about bitter voters, Hillary Clinton's whiskey shots and gun stories, John McCain's family money. Once again, a presidential campaign has come to who's elite and who isn't. Our linguist Jeff Nunberg explains the history of the E-word and its cultural evolution.
People are always splitting off new meanings for words, but every once in a while they'll smush together two old ones. As with other kinds of inbreeding, the process can produce monsters. Take the curious recent development of the noun elite. Until not long ago, it was a barely nativized French word that still wore a jaunty, acute accent on its E. Now it's a word that can drive items like Iraq and immigration to the bottom of the network's debate agenda. Elite used to have two distinct meanings. It could be a la-di-da word for the upper crust, what people used to call the bon ton. Or more consequentially, it could denote the interlocking command structure of society that the sociologist C. Wright Mills referred to in the title of his classic 1956 book, The Power Elite. As Mills described them, those were the people who rule the big corporations, run the machinery of the state, and direct the military establishment. Until a few decades ago, the two senses of elite rarely even nodded to each other. The first appeared only in the society pages and the names of pastry shops. The second showed up only in political dispatches and sociology journals. The blurring of those two senses was first audible in the 1960s when Spiro Agnew first put the phrase media elite into wide circulation and joined it with descriptions like effete snobs, which suggested the social meaning of the word. But the new meaning of elite didn't really start to emerge until the summer of 1992, when Vice President Dan Quayle sparked a national controversy by denouncing Candace Bergen's TV character Murphy Brown for having a child out of wedlock. Quayle put the blame on a cultural elite who were mocking ordinary Americans in newsrooms, sitcom studios, and faculty lounges all over America. "We have two cultures," he said, "the cultural elite and the rest of us." Those attacks weren't sufficient to save the Bush-Quayle ticket in the fall elections, but they did put the E-word at the center of national attention. When he was asked who exactly made up the cultural elite, Quayle answered coyly, "They know who they are." But Newsweek obligingly provided a list of its 100 most prominent members, which even-handedly included both poster child liberals like Bill Moyers, Frank Rich, and Oprah, and conservatives like William Bennett, George Will, and Lynn Cheney. By any reasonable measure of cultural influence, those were all uncontroversial calls. But by then, the noun elite had been sent spinning inexorably leftward. It wasn't just that it was now exclusively prefixed by liberal and that it suggested a seditious taste in cheese and beverages. Even the job descriptions of the elite had changed, so that the qualifier cultural had come to seem redundant. In the British media, you still see elite used predominantly to refer to economic and business leaders, whether you look at the left-wing Guardian or Rupert Murdoch's Times of London. But on Murdoch's Fox News, references to the media elite outnumber references to the business and corporate elite by 40-1. And the disproportion is only slightly less dramatic on CNN. When Americans hear elite these days, they're less likely to think of the managers and politicians who inhabit the corridors of power than of the celebrities, academics, and journalists who lodge in its outer boroughs. It remained only for the noun elite to undergo its final democratization, where it was emptied of its last connections to social position or to actual wealth or power. All that was left of its original meanings was the implication of insufferable pretension and an unwarranted sense of entitlement. As the conservative radio host Laura Ingraham explains it in her book Shut Up and Sing, elite Americans are defined not so much by class or wealth or position as they are by a general outlook. Their core belief is that they're superior to we the people. They think we're stupid. They think where we live is stupid. They think our SUVs are stupid. They think our guns are stupid. That broadened meaning of elite can create some confusion for liberals who haven't quite cottoned to it. They're apt to get indignant when they hear elite pronounced with a sneer by people who would have unquestionably qualified for the label under its traditional definition. And they may be puzzled by the expansive use of we that modern critics of elites tend to fall into when they're talking about non-elite Americans. How does a Connecticut-raised, Ivy-educated lawyer like Ingram get to share a first-person plural pronoun with a working-class deer hunter from western Pennsylvania? For that matter, what are we supposed to make of that pronoun we when we hear the quintessential blue state conservative David Brooks asking, is Barack Obama somebody who doesn't know anything about the way the American people actually live? Or does he actually get the way we live? I mean, if you give Brooks that we, who's the they supposed to be? But then if you don't have to have money, power, or influence to qualify as elite, it follows that having those things doesn't necessarily disqualify you from being one of the rest of us, so long as you can knock back a shot occasionally and don't stop channeling your inner G-dropper. The crucial thing, as Barack Obama learned, is not to be caught seeming to be out of touch, a phrase that Google News paired with his name in more than 3,500 stories after the Bittergate episode. Summer wherever you like, but if you don't want to be described as elite, you'd better know who Dale Earnhardt Jr. is.
Jeff Nunberg is a linguist who teaches at the School of Information at the University of California at Berkeley. It's been 9 years since Jerry Seinfeld made the last episode of his hit TV series. At 53, he's now married and has 3 children, and last fall he unveiled the project he'd spent much of the previous 4 years developing, the animated film B-Movie. B-Movie, which Seinfeld co-wrote and stars in, along with Renee Zellweger and Matthew Broderick, is now out on DVD. But even before B-Movie was released, Seinfeld had returned to his original love, stand-up comedy. He has upcoming dates in 9 cities. I spoke to Jerry Seinfeld last fall, when B-Movie was released in theaters. When you do stand-up, I mean, that's nothing is more autonomous than the stand-up comedian. It's his act, and the feedback is immediate. I mean, you go in, you bomb, whatever, you kill.
Maybe doing stand-up alone by yourself could be more autonomous.
Possibly. And the feedback would be even more immediate, maybe.
Right, that's right.
But, you know, a movie takes years. It begins with endless meetings. Mm-hmm. There's endless editing. How did you adjust to the pace of it?
I didn't adjust very well, to be honest with you. It's it kind of goes against my natural instinct, which is I want to hear tonight if this is any funny or not. You have test screenings, and it was just like being strapped down for 4 years. You know, I know a lot of other comedy writers and comedians that would look at me and they would say, "You're still working on that movie?"
Right.
And I go, "Yeah, we're still going." I mean, 4 years, it's like I know people that wrote movies, got them produced, edited, released, went on to other movies.
I wanted to talk a little bit about your stand-up, which has, you know, been your core for years. And I wanted to play a clip. And this is not you at a club. It's actually a clip from an appearance on Letterman. And I got it from the documentary you did, Comedian. Uh-huh. And the context here is this is after the show has been off the air for a while, and you're coming back, and it's a TV appearance. I don't know if you remember this. Let's listen.
Thank you. Thank you. I appreciate that. I totally appreciate what you're saying. I do, but the question is this. What have I been doing? Everybody says to me, "Hey, you don't do the show anymore. What do you do?" I'll tell you what I do. Nothing. Yeah, I know what you're thinking. That sounds pretty good. You're thinking, I might like to do nothing myself. Well, let me tell you, doing nothing is not as easy as it looks. You have to be careful. Because the idea of doing anything, which could easily lead to doing something, that would cut into your nothing, and that would force me to have to drop everything.
And that's Jerry Seinfeld, our guest from an appearance on the David Letterman show many years ago. You know what I love about that clip is that you got 4 or 5 really good laughs out of what, one joke?
Nothing.
No, hardly a joke. I mean, and it shows all those years in clubs. You've just got the pacing and the punch exactly where you want it.
Thank you.
I know you spent all those years. You made your first appearance on The Tonight Show in 1981.
Mm-hmm.
And through the 80s, you're building a reputation as a stand-up at a time when there are a lot of other comedians that are out there that are maybe getting more attention by being outrageous or profane or kind of using props or crazy characters. And I wondered, you know, kind of gave them an identity and a hook. Did you ever try that stuff, or were you ever tempted to try it?
No, I never was. And I always felt like I was very much a hookless comedian, and I would always be hookless. And that, I thought, maybe that's my hook, you know, that I just don't have anything that you latch on to as he's the guy who does this or looks like this. And but it wouldn't have felt right anyway. I mean that was kind of the joke about the show, was that it was about nothing. But what it really was about was the way we executed it. And it's the same thing as what my stand-up is about. It's the same thing as what that joke was about. What is that joke? It's taking the word nothing, something, everything, and anything, and assembling it into a thought that makes sense. And so that's really what I like to do. I'm more into the execution than I am anything other aspect of it. I mean, I don't even care about being famous or being, you know, I just enjoy the doing of the thing.
Well, you know, in the documentary Comedian, which is, you know, for those who haven't seen it, it's you going back to stand-up after having done the show and kind of getting back into it. And there's this moment in it that I really love where you've sort of built the act up toward – you've now got a good 50 minutes. And you do an appearance, I think, at a club in Washington, D.C. And it seems to have gone pretty well. But after it, you're not satisfied and you're saying, God, it's just so hard to really – feel comfortable, and you're kind of bemoaning whether you really hit it as you're packing your stuff and getting into your private jet, or what looks like your private jet.
Yeah.
And so what's fascinating is we have you who have all that money and success that insist on subjecting yourself to this ego-battering process of getting back in live clubs.
Mm-hmm.
You always want to do that. Why?
You know, it's just that feeling of not cheating that is I think the best feeling in life. I didn't cheat at that. And stand-up is the only thing that I knew that I could be sure that if I was doing it and audiences were responding well, that I wasn't cheating. Because there is no way to cheat in stand-up. It's the nakedest, purest thing in the world. But I could have gone into a movie. Someone would say, we have a great idea for a movie for you. And they could have put me in a movie and promoted the movie. And the movie did this, and I would never know, was that any good or not?
Right.
You know, say, well, the director didn't handle you right, or it wasn't promoted the way it should have been. There's always a million excuses. There's no excuses in stand-up. So after all of that experience of Hollywood and television and everything that the show did, I just wanted to get back to something that I knew what was right and wrong and what was black and white. And it's a very black and white world. And that was a calming to me, and that was – it just would make me feel I just never wanted to feel like I was skating on a reputation or, you know.
And you can't skate on a reputation at a live club?
No, absolutely not.
Even if you're Jerry Seinfeld?
Even if you're Jerry Seinfeld. Maybe a couple of minutes. They may give you 3 or 4 free minutes at the top, but after a while, no one laughs at a reputation. It's not funny.
And did you get where you wanted to be? Did you get comfortable?
I did finally. It took about 4 or 5 years of working. And I've lost it a little bit now doing the movie, and I'm going to go back. But it's kind of a tennis game. A stand-up act is like a tennis game. And even if you're good, you got to keep playing if you want to keep that game at a certain point.
And you're sure you want to keep playing?
I love the simplicity of it. I love the purity of it. It's just – this is what the – I mean, all this work that we went into the movie – I mean, to make an animated movie, the infrastructure of DreamWorks is $1 billion. That's what it costs just to have the machines to make one of these things. And then the years of work – and what is it all for? It's so that when we put it in front of the audience, you hear a laugh.
Same thing as standing up and telling a joke, right?
Same thing. So, you know, I like it's the difference between, you know – you say you like the water. Well, you can be the captain of a ship or you can surf.
Right.
And stand-up's like surfing. You're just right there with it.
Well, since you were last on Fresh Air, you did this TV series, which kind of took off.
Right.
And it's a sort of a measure of its cultural reach. You know, my wife had a career change this year, and she had about 6 weeks between her old job and when she began her new life as a resident in psychiatry, which was in June and July. And I began referring to this time, which she'd look forward to so much, as her Summer of George, which, for folks who may not recall, was the Seinfeld episode where George Costanza has a summer off and he buys an easy chair with a built-in refrigerator.
Right.
And what's funny about it is that, you know, when I kind of came up with that phrase, everybody in my family laughed and talked about it. She would talk about her friends. They all knew exactly what we were talking about.
Right.
And in a way, those that series, which you haven't made a new episode in 9 years now, mm-hmm. but it's all over a television, mm-hmm. is sort of this book of life. I mean, people use moments and lines from that series to describe what's going on in their lives. You're aware of this phenomenon.
I am, but I don't get it. I mean, it mystifies me as much as you, and I'm only happy that it's doing something for somebody.
That doesn't mystify me, because you're capturing stuff that we all kind of recognize.
Right, but isn't every – why is it different in other comedy shows? Why can't you name other comedy shows? Somebody, you know, Larry David said to me the other day that this was the first show where people would say, well, that's a Seinfeld episode about something that – I had a day today that sounds like a Seinfeld episode, that our show was for some reason lent people to think like that about their own lives. Because I guess maybe one of the reasons is we stayed so close to the people's real lives. We tried to anyway, as much as we could, aside from, you know, hitting golf balls into the blowhole of a whale.
Right.
And maybe that's why people can analogize to it or from it.
How did you know when it was time for the show to end?
If from my stage act. The stage act, you know, if I had been doing comedy, let's see, about 23 years at that time. And you start to know on stage when to get off. There's just this feeling that you develop from years and years of doing it. You just feel that we're getting – everyone's really having a good time, and I think in another few minutes this is going to start to get old. Good night, everybody. And right. And everyone's happy. And I'm sure you've had the experience – everyone's had the experience of going to a movie that you love, but for some reason they just make it 15 minutes longer than it really needed to be. And the change in your feeling about the movie because of that little 15 minutes, and they may not even be a bad 15 minutes. It's just proportions. You know, I guess it's a function of art and an economy. That economy is essential to all good art. And I thought, let's – even though we had done a lot, 9 years, 180 episodes, I thought we can't do one too many or it's going to taint the whole thing. So it was more the energy I felt around the show itself.
That's what's interesting, because on stage you've got that you say you have that sense from the audience that you've honed over the years.
Right. It was in the office. It was in the office of the show. The writers would come in, and the way they would look at me, when they would say, so I had a thought that maybe Kramer would, you know, become friends with a penguin or something, you know, and I would hear it in their voice. They're not as excited. This is getting old. And I thought, well, if it's happening here, the audience is next.
Right.
And, you know, I had a meeting with Jack Welch, and he showed me these. It was a hilarious meeting where he
was the chairman of –
the chairman of GE at the time, and they owned NBC. And he had these charts of the ratings and the demographics of the show. And every chart showed the numbers going up. He said, you have improved your audience from the eighth season to the ninth. The ninth is stronger than the eighth. So it was all backwards. You know, usually you go in there, you try and tell them why you deserve more money and why the show should be kept on. And it was everything was backwards. I'm telling him, no, we shouldn't go anymore. He says, no, you should. I'll give you a raise. I'll give you more money. You know, I said, I don't want money. I want the audience to have this thing. It was kind of like, and I don't mean to compare myself in any way, shape, or form to the Beatles, but when the Beatles ended, it was so sudden, and it made what they did somehow more valuable.
Right.
Because it just suddenly was over, and that's it. That's the complete set. You know, 9 years, 12 albums, whatever it is, that's it. So I kind of took from that, I want to try and do that.
You know, it's funny. I can't help but think of the episode in the series when George Costanza adopts this posture and in a meeting gets one funny line that cracks off a line that breaks the room up and he says,
right.
That's it, I'm done, I'm out of here.
That's where the idea came from.
Jerry Seinfeld recorded in October. His animated film, B-Movie, is out on DVD. Errol Morris, the director of A Thin Blue Line, Dr. Death, and Fog of War, has a new documentary called Standard Operating Procedure. Morris uses on-screen interviews, stylized reenactments, and special effects to present his perspective on the scandal over the Abu Ghraib prison photos. Film critic David Edelstein has this review.
Pictures don't lie. That's what Special Agent Brent Pack tells Errol Morris's camera in Standard Operating Procedure. And the film suggests that he's right and wrong. Pack helped convict several Abu Ghraib guards on the evidence of widely circulated photos, the ones from that infamous night in 2003 in the prison basement when naked Iraqis were forced to touch themselves and straddle one another in a human pyramid, and when a close-cropped, diminutive gargoyle named Lindy England led a naked Iraqi on a leash. Nightmare stuff, seared into the public's imagination. But the question Morris poses is just as haunting. If those pictures exposed some truths about Abu Ghraib, did they conceal other, even larger ones? Morris has hold of a huge subject, one in which politics and art bleed together. Using his own standard operating procedure, fixed camera interviews, slow motion reenactments, a busy and hypnotic score by Danny Elfman, the director keeps looping back to what happened outside the frame, before and after the photos and a video were shot. Over and over, he shows us the infamous images, then effectively subverts them by giving us the context. Lindy England speaks, filmed like her fellow ex-soldiers in the standard Errol Morris style, close up against a neutral background. You wouldn't recognize her. Her face has filled out, and her hair is dark and abundant. She was demonized in the media, dishonorably discharged and imprisoned, one of a group that Donald Rumsfeld dismissed as a few bad apples. But this bad apple is disconcertingly human. England was prodded into taking that leash by a man she loved and whose baby she'd have, Charles Grainer, the Busby Berkeley of the Abu Ghraib danse macabre. She wasn't yanking that Iraqi, she says. The leash is slack. And what happened that night was typical, not extraordinary.
We didn't kill them. We didn't cut their heads off. We didn't shoot them. We didn't cut them and let them bleed to death. We just did what we were told to soften them up for interrogation. And we were told to do anything short of killing them. We'd make them stand in awkward positions for hours at a time to stress them out and to strain them. And we would have them crawl up and down the tier. We'd pour cold water on them.
In films like Dr. Death and A Thin Blue Line, Morris makes his subjects look like specimens in a jar. He lets them go on and on until they hang themselves. Standard Operating Procedure has a less detached, less ironic, more sympathetic vantage. As Morris weaves together the accounts of the Abu Ghraib participants, it's as if he's using his own camera to liberate them from someone else's. You can believe Lindy England or not, but there was more in those photos than met the lens. Even with his disturbing reenactments, it's possible that Morris errs on the side of sympathy. What are we to make of the guard Sabrina Harmon's broad smile astride a human pyramid? She tells Morris that when you pose for a photo, you want to smile. Well, yes, and no. But she reads from a letter to her partner, Kelly, in which her shame is right there on the surface. The world of Abu Ghraib these ex-soldiers depict is morally upending. We see photos and hear accounts of an Iraqi found dead after a brutal interrogation. He's zipped into a body bag, iced down, then dragged to the showers so he'd look, despite his horrific bruises, as if he'd keeled over from a heart attack. It's the stuff of grisly farce. Brigadier General Janice Karpinski, who had responsibility for the prison, supplies a wider context. She recalls Rumsfeld underlings directing guards to, quote, treat the prisoners like dogs, and was relieved of command when the world saw them doing just that. But for a more overarching view of the administration's strategy, I recommend Alex Gibney's Oscar-winning Taxi to the Dark Side. Gibney depicts the directives as purposefully vague, relentless pressure for results, plus what one official calls a fog of ambiguity regarding what is and is not permitted. See Standard Operating Procedure for its faces, its riveting narrative, and for the monkey wrench Morris throws into the cogs of our perceptions. The special agent who testified against the guards, Brent Pack, says, "A picture is worth a thousand words." Maybe so, but the movie asks, which words? Whose words?
David Edelstein is film critic for New York Magazine.